From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we look at our society's most abused drugs, cocaine, meth, and heroin, and where we stand in reducing the harm they bring to people's lives. First, we talk with Gary Kendall, director of the Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy. Then we'll hear from Dr. Greg Scott. Scott is featured in the upcoming National Geographic Channel miniseries, Drugs, Inc., which looks at the $300 billion illegal drug trade in this country. Dr. Scott provides backpack outreach, where he goes into homeless encampments and crack houses to save the lives of addicts. A look at reducing drug abuse in the state and in the country after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Good afternoon, I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, an update on drug abuse and drug control policy in our area. Later in the hour, I talk with Greg Scott. Scott is featured in the upcoming National Geographic Channel miniseries, Drugs, Inc. Scott goes into homeless encampments and crack houses in the Chicago area to save the lives of addicts, and we'll hear about that in the second half hour of our program. But first, our guest in the first half hour, Gary Kendall. He is the director of the Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy, joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Des Moines. Welcome back to our program, Gary.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Let's focus on methamphetamine, since that's been a big problem in our state. The second half hour, we do talk quite a bit about heroin and cocaine. But pseudoephedrine is a decongestant that can be used to make meth. A new monitoring system, an electronic database for pseudoephedrine, was approved by the legislature two sessions ago. A pilot project was started then. The full compliance date with the Iowa law is September 1st. It's coming up, but it's already an option, though not already in operation, though not widely in some parts of Iowa. Tell us about this new monitoring system.
Well, basically, it's a chance for us to put all of the purchase information together in one database. So what we'll do is stop people from going from pharmacy to pharmacy and buying their limit of pseudoephedrine at each pharmacy that they go to, which has been happening over the last couple of years since we passed the restrictions that put it behind the counter and placed a limit on how much they could buy.
So how do we know that they've been going? How do we measure that they've been going from pharmacy to pharmacy?
Well, basically, they've been required, since the passage of the previous law, they've been required to fill out paper logs at each pharmacy. And we know from reports from pharmacists and pharmacies, as well as law enforcement reviewing those logs on occasion, that's what's happening. And then we're also hearing it from just intelligence from informants that are providing information to law enforcement about how the manufacture of methamphetamine is occurring currently in our state.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about how much pseudoephedrine people can buy now where these new monitoring, these pilot projects are not in place. That allows them to go from store to store.
Sure. The limits are 3,600 milligrams of pseudo within a 24-hour period and also 7,500 milligrams of pseudoephedrine product within a 30-day period. So there's actually there's two different restrictions. It's that 24-hour restriction as well as the 30-day collective restriction.
Joining our discussion now is Sherry Rockhold Schmidt. She is a pharmacist at Medicap Pharmacy in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Sherry.
Good afternoon.
Your pharmacy is part of the pseudoephedrine monitoring pilot project, the one that I mentioned that began about 2 years ago. Describe how the monitoring system works there at your pharmacy.
During the pilot program, the way it would work is the person would come in and ask to purchase the pseudoephedrine. And we would swipe the person's driver's license along with the barcode of the product that they're purchasing, and it would go into a real-time database for all other pharmacies that were participating. So the data was there for all pharmacies participating, where law enforcement could see if patients were doing exactly what Gary was talking about earlier, going from pharmacy to pharmacy to pharmacy in one day and purchasing products.
Mm-hmm. So is it the case that when you swipe the card and you see or you enter that data that you get a red flag, or is it law enforcement that gets the red flag and has to act?
law enforcement gets the red flag and has to act.
So you, is there a point in which you look into this and you deny anyone pseudoephedrine?
Yes. With the pilot project, there was not. But my understanding is with the new program that gets rolled out on September 1st, since there'll be all pharmacies online, we will get a notification that the person is purchasing over the amount, and we have the ability to deny the sale. Mm-hmm.
And Gary Kendall, perhaps you can fill us in on that point. So it will be slightly different now than it is for the pilot project people.
That's correct. The pilot was a voluntary participation, and we were really appreciative of all those folks like Sherry's shop that participated because it helped us advance the ball on this. But now the system that's taking effect is a mandatory participation system, so all pharmacies that sell pseudoephedrine products in the state are going to have to participate in this. And mm-hmm. Sherry's right. You'll get that message that they can then deny the sale.
That will become immediately within seconds of that swipe.
That's right.
Okay. Sherry, have you noticed any difference in the way people are buying their drugs, their pseudoephedrine?
I don't know if we've noticed a difference in the way people are buying it, but we've certainly noticed a difference as far as being easier to tell when people are purchasing. If we have suspicion that somebody is going from place to place purchasing it, it's our duty to investigate that and to make sure that's not happening. And so... You know, previously we would spend a lot of time on the phone calling around trying to figure out where they had been and what they had purchased. So,
mm-hmm. Well, yeah, what is it that leads to a suspicion that someone might be using this to produce meth? Is it networking with other pharmacies in the area, or is it appearance partly that tips you off?
I wouldn't say it's not appearance in general, although sometimes it can be, but it's networking with other pharmacies, and a lot of times it's the quantity that they ask for, the type of product that they ask for, just noticing patterns in how and when they purchase at our pharmacy, as well as them not being, you know, if they're not a customer at our pharmacy, but they're coming, you know, every so many days to purchase their allotted quantity of pseudoephedrine, mm-hmm. that can be a tip-off as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that they're learning, the people who are making meth using this, learning to get through the existing system?
Absolutely.
How are they doing that?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how they're doing it, but what it appears to us is that they have certain towns that they go to on certain days, and, you know, they know that they can purchase 7,500 milligrams every 30 days and the 3,600 milligrams every 24 hours. So, for instance, in Ames, they might come to Ames and hit all 12 pharmacies that were here today or, you know, some of these pharmacies, and then they don't come back to Ames for another 15 days when they're allowed to have another purchase. So in the meantime, they're in another town doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. We want to make sure, of course, the state has no intention of damaging business at a pharmacy. How has the new monitoring system affected your business, the money you bring in?
I don't think it's affected our business negatively at all. In fact, I think it's freed us up and given us more time to actually fill prescriptions and counsel patients and, you know, do the things that we're supposed to do, because we're not spending as much time on the phone calling all the other pharmacies in town trying to figure out if purchases were legitimate or not.
So you're looking forward to this new system. It will relieve a burden that you've had.
I'm definitely looking forward to it. I think there's probably some pharmacists that haven't been involved in the pilot program that are a little apprehensive just because it's a change and it's different, and there'll be some training and some new software and that type of thing. But I think in general, once everyone sees how it works and how much easier it is, it'll be a much better system going forward.
What is the reaction generally of customers when they are asked to present an ID for pseudoephedrine?
In the beginning, there was, you know, a little bit of resistance 2 years ago when it first started, but most people are very appreciative that something is being done to stop the illegal drugs on the street, and most people say, you know, anything we can do to help, and we don't mind showing an ID. It's a little bit of a minor inconvenience, but now 2 years into it, of showing IDs, it's just habit. Most of the time they come, if they purchase it on a regular basis, they come and they have their ID ready and, mm-hmm. and they know that they need to show it.
And if they're not aware, then a little bit of explanation it usually does the trick?
Correct, yes. Mm-hmm. And once we tell them why, you know, they're more than happy to show it.
Have you noticed that this pilot project, the new pseudoephedrine tracking, prohibits people in any way from legitimately buying the drug when they medically need it?
No, I have not noticed that. And in fact, for some patients, they can still get prescriptions for larger quantities or larger amounts if it's needed. So they, if they have something where they have a legitimate need that is above the current law, they can see their physician and they can actually have a prescription written, and then that gets dispensed differently as a prescription. So if there's a legitimate need, it's definitely available to them.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to Gary Kendall, Director of the Governor's Office for Drug Control Policy, quickly before our break, too. Now, in the pilot project, a pilot project is there, of course, to learn from. What are the chief things that you have learned from this pilot project that included Sherry's Pharmacy in Ames?
Well, probably the primary thing is that it has to be a mandatory participation system. We tried to make it work with a voluntary program, and that just we didn't get enough participation of some of the pharmacies. So that's a key element of it. Providing as much information to the pharmacist as we can is another important thing, but at the same time, our goal was to make it actually easier and simplify the process and reduce the amount of time spent by the pharmacies dealing with pseudoephedrine products. And I think, I really believe once we get this system up and running, we're going to find that all those are true.
Sherry, are there other drugs behind the counter there that you can think of that such a tracking system might be useful for?
There are. There's some cough medicines with codeine are also sold currently by a paper log, so that's a potential. Plan B is kept behind the counter and sold. You don't have to have a paper tracking system for it, but it is kept behind the counter and purchases are monitored. So I think definitely there are some, it would be nice also to have some of the prescription products that are abused available to be used in this type of a system as well.
Mm-hmm. Is this part of your intention or anything that has been discussed, Gary Kendall, that this might be a good pilot project for other drugs that may be abused in different ways?
I think that's always a possibility going forward. Our focus to this point has been really only on pseudoephedrine products because of the connection to methamphetamine and domestic production. There is a kind of a parallel system. It's called a prescription drug monitoring program that the Board of Pharmacy in Iowa has that tracks all prescription drugs. But there again, that's a voluntary participation system, and it's not a real-time system. So it's not as ideal as we'd like to see it as relating to some of these controlled substances.
Gary Kendall, please stand by. Director of the Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy. I want to say thank you very much to Sherry Rockhold-Schmidt. You are working right now. Thank you for being able to step, your colleagues too, for allowing you to step away from the counter. I know you have to get back to the pharmacy at Medicap Pharmacy in Ames. Sherry, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And when we come back, I want to ask Gary Kendall if the state is on track to meet this deadline, September 1st, to be in full compliance with tracking pseudoephedrine sales. Is our meth problem better now than it was a few months ago? We'll find out when we come back. We'd like you to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, talking about drug abuse and drug control policy. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Back in 1 minute. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, an update on drug abuse and drug control policy. Gary Kendall with us for the first half hour, Director of the Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy, talking about a new system that will be supposed to be put in place by September 1st to track pseudoephedrine sales with an electronic database. Before we get to that question, back to that new tracking system, remind us, Gary Kendall, about meth use in Iowa. How many users are there, do we think? Is it getting worse or better?
Oh, I don't know if we could say that it's getting worse and better. Those numbers fluctuate, for a lot of factors. I think we've seen a general decline in the numbers reported, including prison admissions, burn unit admissions, treatment admissions, but I don't know that that necessarily translates to fewer users. I think really that's attributable to our passage of this pseudoephedrine law a few years ago because we haven't had as much domestic production, and I think most of the folks that enter the treatment system get there through the criminal justice system. Most of the people that enter the prison system obviously get there through the criminal justice system. And so because we have fewer domestic meth labs, we're seeing a reduction in those numbers. I don't know that we can necessarily say that translates to a reduction in usage, though.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us any idea in terms of numbers how many meth users, meth addicts there are within our state borders?
It'd be a really rough estimate based on treatment admissions. I think we're still at roughly 13 or 14% of treatment admissions in the state are for methamphetamine as their primary drug of abuse. But again, that's only counting the folks that are in treatment. So I think it's really hard to estimate that number.
Thousands, tens of thousands.
Yeah, easily. Yeah,
easily tens of thousands.
Easily.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that we cut down on the domestic production of meth through the previous laws that have been put in place. Have you noticed that meth producers, where are people getting meth now since it's not as highly produced here? Are you seeing an increase in the borders coming in through the Iowa's borders?
Yeah, we've always had a presence of the Mexican drug trafficking organizations in our state, at least ever since I've been around the business, which was early 90s. And that they already had that framework and that existing distribution network. And so when we clamped down on domestic production, they just simply increased the amount of product they were bringing in. So there's still plenty of meth to be found. There's some of the activities that the federal authorities are doing at the border have been helpful. We're seeing at times we're seeing the purity fluctuate, which shows that it's harder to get it through the border and that more of it's being seized. So, and the price is fluctuating a fair amount. We're seeing some price increases at times that also indicates they're having trouble getting across the border. So some of those federal activities have made it a little bit more challenging, but there's still plenty of meth in the state for folks that are trying to get it.
Of course, in the news, we've been hearing a lot about the Mexican drug war. Is that having any effect? We hear about the horrendous number of deaths in border towns along the U.S. border. Do you notice that here when you're in charge of drug policy in any way?
Thankfully, we haven't seen the violence that's been associated with the Mexican authorities' attempt to crack down on these folks. I'm sure, unfortunately, it's probably only a matter of time, but I'm sure the southwest border area will see that before we ever do. We see in the occasional, situation that I think law enforcement attributes to narcotics trafficking, but it's definitely not to the level that they're seeing elsewhere in the country and in Mexico.
Let me return to the new monitoring system for pseudoephedrine that was approved by the legislature two sessions ago, and there have been pilot projects out there. Now, is the state on track to meet this deadline coming up September 1st to be in full compliance with tracking pseudoephedrine sales?
Yeah, we're on track to do that. That's actually a deadline we set. The legislation was passed, and it was passed in such a way that it was only going to be implemented if we had resources to do it. And Senator Harkin and Senator Grassley obtained an earmark for my office to be able to implement and administer this program. So we've been able to move forward with that. In addition, a group of manufacturers got together and basically paid for this product, and they're offering this tracking system to any state that wants to use it free of charge. So that allows us to use the funding that the senators obtained for us to help pharmacies in the way of equipment and software adjustments that they need that we wouldn't have been able to help with otherwise. So it's really on track.
For a pharmacy like Sherry's, they will bear no cost for this change? Can you say that?
Well, I can't say no cost, but it'll be pretty minimal cost. There won't be any cost for the actual software. There won't be if they need a handheld scanner, if they don't have it integrated with their computer system, we're going to be able to provide a scanner to them. There may be some upgrade cost on the software in the future, but initially the product we're being able to put out there is going to be of no cost to them.
I understand that Iowa's monitoring system, the new one, is the same as what our neighbor Illinois has. Will there be any cross-border monitoring? Because, of course, for instance, in the Quad Cities, you could buy it in Davenport and then go right across the border to Rock Island and buy some more, unless you had that monitoring that crossed borders.
Right. That's one of the neat things about going with the system and the fact that that consortium of manufacturers stepped up and offered this to any state that wants to use it. We're going to be able to do that cross-border monitoring with Illinois. Missouri's in the process of implementing it, Kansas, and I believe Nebraska is taking steps. They haven't passed a law yet, but hopefully we're going to have most, if not all, of our border states using this same system here within the next year or two.
Can you give us a concrete instance where this has worked? Anyone been caught because this new system, if only in its pilot form, has been in place?
I can't give you names, but I know in Story County, Sheriff Fitzgerald up in Story County worked with Sherry on this pilot project as well as the other. He went to all the pharmacies in his jurisdiction and got them all to voluntarily participate in this, the ones that did. And he's been a real help in getting this system in place in Iowa. I know he's had they have the Central Iowa Drug Task Force up there, and I know they've had several cases that have been developed based upon information that was gleaned from this tracking system.
In the second half of the show, perhaps you heard we'll be talking not only about meth but also heroin and cocaine as well. Give us an update about the abuse of these other drugs in the state, cocaine,
sure,
heroin.
They're really holding steady. I mean, they're not to the level that methamphetamine is. You see the heroin more in college towns and cocaine.
College towns in Iowa?
Right. That's where
Ames, Iowa City, Cedar Falls, you see heroin use.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's changed somewhat. I mean, I think some people probably have in their head, if they think of a heroin user, if they think of anything, they probably think of, some kind of dirty, scroungy person, in the alley shooting it in their arm. And it's not necessarily the case anymore. There's a little bit more, unfortunately, more clean way to use heroin. And it's, you're seeing it more in areas that have that college presence in the town. And there's a number of reasons for that, but obviously some of it is the market of the college students.
The market, what do you mean by that?
Just meaning the college students are interested in it.
Oh, I see, that they just prefer one drug over the other.
Right.
How can you describe the connection between these hard illicit drugs one another? Do users generally focus on one, or do they migrate from one to the next and escalating, so to speak, perhaps beginning even with marijuana?
Yeah, it's typically drug users are polydrug users, which means obviously they'll use more than one at a time. I think it's safe to say, generally speaking, and I'm sure some people would criticize me for this, but generally speaking, I think most people that use those harder drugs like heroin, cocaine, meth, at some point in time previous to that usage, used marijuana and probably also used, cigarettes and alcohol. So I think there's a natural transition that happens in a person's drug use life. And if they move on to those harder drugs, they're going to end up being a polydrug user and, mm-hmm. and not just using heroin, but they'll use heroin or they'll use, OxyContin or they'll use methamphetamine, whatever they can get their hands on that particular day.
Gary Kendall, we have less than a minute left. Give us a picture of what you hope will be the net effect of this new monitoring and other steps that you're taking on drug abuse and in drug control policy in the state in 5-10 years.
Our number one goal with the monitoring system is to reduce the amount of pseudoephedrine that's going across pharmacy counters that's used in the manufacture of meth. And I without a doubt, this system is going to do that. We have really terrific pharmacists in this state, and I think we're very lucky in that regard. Some of my colleagues in other states have had challenges in working with their pharmacy communities, and I can't say that. I'm just delighted with the response that we've gotten from our pharmacists, and they're really engaged, and they really want to do the right thing and try to help reduce the meth problem in our state. And,
Gary Kendall, we have to go. I want to thank you very much for joining us, giving us that update. Gary Kendall, Director of the Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy. Gary, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll hear from Greg Scott. Scott is featured in the upcoming National Geographic Channel miniseries, Drugs, Inc. That's when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour. This Sunday at 7 p.m., the National Geographic Channel premieres a new miniseries called Drugs, Inc. The series looks at our society's most abused drugs and where we stand in reducing the harm they bring to people's lives. It features a variety of first-person perspectives, from traffickers, dealers, and users to law enforcement and medical professionals. The series includes a look at the work of my next guest, Greg Scott of Chicago. And here's an excerpt from the new series, the National Geographic Channel series, Drugs, Inc.
Greg Scott, Research Director of the Chicago Recovery Alliance, sees the 50,000 addicts in his city not as criminals, but victims in need of medical treatment.
I specialize in going into homeless encampments, shooting galleries, crack houses, other areas where people are in their natural setting using their drugs.
Greg's day begins on the wrong side of the tracks. He heads to some of the city's most dangerous neighborhoods to help homeless addicts.
Joseph!
Opiates like heroin kill more people than any other narcotic, around 100,000 a year worldwide. Its victims die primarily from infection from dirty needles or overdose.
Yo!
Greg is trying to fight both.
I think all the kids is over here.
Pop. Bye. How you doing, man? I will retrieve, I'll pick up dirty syringes, whatever they may have to give me, and I distribute to them sterile syringes, clean paraphernalia. How you doing,
yo?
We're good. Good.
Greg's not just handing out clean needles. He's also armed with a weapon that can combat overdose. The heroin antidote.
It's an excerpt from the new National Geographic Channel series featuring Greg Scott in this case. Greg Scott joins us now live by phone from Chicago. Good afternoon, Greg.
Good afternoon. How are you, Ben?
Very well. I want to update people on your other credentials here. You're an associate professor of sociology, also the director of the Social Science Research Center at DePaul University there in Chicago. Since 2001, you've served as the director of research for the Chicago Recovery Alliance. We heard a bit of a description about your work to help addicts in Chicago that you've been doing over years. You do more than just distribute clean needles. Tell us about the different facets of your work with addicts.
Well, my work with addicts is multifaceted. I engage in research, documentary, film, and audio, but also and always in the context of what we call harm reduction outreach. I am the director of research for the Chicago Recovery Alliance, which is one of the nation's largest and most pioneering harm reduction organizations. It centers around sterile syringe exchange, providing sterile syringes and clean paraphernalia to drug injectors, people who inject crack and or heroin, and who are in need of such supplies. We also take in their contaminated syringes and dispose of them properly. We do HIV testing, hepatitis C testing. We also do vaccination for hepatitis A and B. And I spend a lot of time teaching drug injectors how to inject more hygienically so as to minimize the probability that they'll transmit or acquire an infection such as HIV or hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of resistance to this type of work? I know you're doing pioneering work there. I imagine there must be. Still the idea out there that these people should be locked up, not given or enabled, I guess you could say.
Yeah, enabling is one of the words I hear most often from opponents. The opponents to the work we do often want people to be free of drugs. They want them to recover from their addiction. What we believe is that a dead addict cannot recover. So once you're dead, there's really no recovery potential. So harm reduction really revolves around doing everything possible to keep this person as healthy as possible while they're using drugs, to keep them alive long enough so that they can make those decisions that the majority of society would approve of, basically. So, you know, we want to keep them alive, which is one of the principal reasons that we distribute the antidote to heroin or all, really, opiate overdose, a drug called naloxone. We freely distribute it, put it in the hands of users. They teach their peers how to use it just in case they happen to fall out from an overdose, which is the leading cause of death among opiate addicts.
In fact, we wanted to play another clip from the National Geographic Channel series Drugs, Inc. that features your work with someone. This is you literally very, very probably saving someone's life. The clip we want to play, I'm sure you remember this, the dramatic encounter you had with a Chicago heroin addict, a prostitute named Laura. And in this clip, you come across her while you are with another woman named Kat. Tell us who Kat is. We'll hear another voice in this. Yeah.
Kat is a local hustler. She's kind of a madam matriarch, a former prostitute herself. veteran crack smoker, basically now makes her money dealing small time in crack and also setting up dates for other women.
Okay, so we're going to begin when we come upon this woman. So you and Kat are walking down the street. You come upon, describe the scene there.
What happens is we're driving by. The crew is in the back seat of the car, and in the car behind me, I see Laura, and Kat has got her pinned up against the brick wall of an apartment building. I assume that Kat is going to beat her up for some infraction that may have occurred in the crack house from which they both came. So I'm thinking I might just pass on by, but instead I decide to stop and say goodbye. We had just come from that very same crack house where I was teaching people how to use this antidote. Laura came in at the tail end, missed the training, promptly injected two bags of heroin, and was overdosing. So Kat yells back to me, she's overdosing.
Okay,
so
that's where we'll pick it up right there. This is from the documentary, the new series by the National Geographic Channel series, part of which features my guest, Greg Scott of Chicago. Let's listen.
You all right?
No, she's not all right.
Boy, you're not really breathing.
Greg's work soon takes an urgent turn.
You all right?
A prostitute from the crack house is overdosing.
Laura, I'm
just
gonna
have
to do it, Laura.
Just give it to her, Greg.
Don't put it.
Greg, she's been up
Laura,
for 3 days.
Laura, you're falling out.
She's been up for 3 days. She
Laura,
just
I'm only
going
to give you a half cc.
Just give it to her.
Greg hits her with the heroin antidote.
Okay, that's an excerpt from the National Geographic Channel series Drugs, Inc., which will premiere this Sunday evening. How many times, Greg, have you done something similar to a very traumatic scene there? As it turned out well, though, if we would listen on to the documentary for Laura.
It did turn out well for Laura, and in fact, about a month later, she went into treatment and is really doing much better these days. Keeping her alive was a good thing, no matter how you slice it. But that was my 24th Narcan-assisted rescue. So that was the 24th time I had used naloxone to reverse an overdose.
And this antidote is something that is the pioneering use of it is in Chicago. How widely is it used now?
Unfortunately, not widely enough. Many states, jurisdictions are reluctant to get into the distribution of naloxone because of this discourse of enabling. And I'll step up and say, yes, I am an enabler. I am enabling as much as I can people to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
But there are legal issues surrounding this. You know, what is the liability if you administer this antidote and it doesn't work? Can you be prosecuted or not? What do the Good Samaritan laws say? We had a revision to our Good Samaritan laws in Illinois, and that was a good thing for us that helps us deal with some of those legal issues a bit. But this drug is very cheap. We're talking about 27 cents per dose. That's 27 cents per life saved. I believe every household in the country should have this drug available, and there should be instructions, sort of a poison control kit. Accidental opiate poisoning is now the second leading cause of death in the United States, second only to motor vehicle accidents. So we're not just talking about street addicts. We're talking about now, in particular, people above the age of 50 who are taking opiates for pain and other conditions.
I don't know how much you know about the scene outside of Chicago there. We had in our first half hour Gary Kendall, director of the Iowa Governor's Office of Drug Control Policy here. I asked him about the use of heroin and cocaine. Heroin, he said there was some use mostly in university cities in Iowa. Do you know anything about the extent of it in the greater Midwest, in Iowa, for example?
Well, I've actually, quite coincidentally, in the past couple of weeks, run across three young people from Iowa City, in fact, who migrated here to Chicago. One of them had a friend who was living here, and they were all in university. These three folks are no longer in university, but rather are living on the West Side, and they're daily heroin injectors. And so, you know,
did you know that if their habit began while they were in Iowa, in Iowa City?
Begin. Yes, in fact, it did. And they, like many young people, and you know, the prescription pharmaceutical scene in Iowa is probably one to be of greater concern to you folks there. Young people are getting their hands on Vicodin, Dilaudid, Percocet, OxyContin, the things that their parents are taking, you know, maybe intermittently for you know, pain, conditions that have arisen, acute conditions, bone breaks and things like that. Spinal pain, back pain, that's another condition for which those of us over the age of 40 sometimes get drugs like Vicodin, which is an opiate, and which this antidote works to reverse, by the way. So they're getting their hands on these pharmaceuticals, so they're quite familiar with the effects of an opiate. And then they see this white powder, and someone tells them, hey, you know, this is going to make you feel the same way the OxyContin does, and they've already taken OxyContin. Mm-hmm. So in Iowa in particular, it's your prescription pharmaceutical diversion that's really more the issue, though certainly heroin is making inroads into your state.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just mentioned three former University of Iowa students on the west side of Chicago now shooting up heroin. Remind us how quickly that can happen, lest someone's out there thinking, oh, well, I'll shoot up heroin once, have the experience because I've maybe had Vicodin. How quickly can this grab hold of you?
It can grab hold of you in the matter of a long weekend. I mean, if you've already been accustomed to, you know, fairly habitual recreational use, partying every weekend, maybe snorting or, you know, some ground up Vicodin or ground up OxyContins, if you're already sort of at that level, you spend one long weekend around someone who's injecting, you're probably going to try it yourself because it's way more economical. It's much more efficient. You get a much better rush from it, and it lasts longer when you take it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, there are many people, a good percentage of people who inject, they experience the nausea, they never want to do it again. But there's a strong minority who will definitely not mind the nausea and will go on to a second, third, fourth injection, and then the pattern has taken hold.
Has drug abuse touched you or a loved one? We want to hear from our exchange listeners. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Greg Scott on the line with us from Chicago of the Chicago Recovery Alliance. He's featured in the upcoming National Geographic Channel series, Drugs, Inc. Let me ask you that question. You're dedicated to this mission. You've been saving lives in Chicago. Tell us, have you, family or your friends, been touched by drug addiction, Greg?
Yes, in fact, family and friends. And I have lost three of the people dearest to me in my life to overdose. So this is, for me, a very personal matter. And it's a lifelong mission. It's that kind of thing that just takes hold of you. And you realize you'll be doing it until you're no longer on the planet.
Hmm. This work is also tied, the work that you do, tied with research that you're doing at DePaul University. Tell us how that ties in and what you're studying specifically.
Specifically, we're looking at overdose. We've been conducting studies on the prevalence, incidence, and geographic location of overdose in Chicago, trying to examine trends. And we're also trying to hatch several studies that will look at the effects at the neighborhood and community level of distributing this antidote. We are seeing a fairly dramatic decline in the rate of overdoses. Now, making the case that we can attribute that to the distribution of the antidote is another matter entirely. That requires a very high level of statistical rigor. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do. Part of that, I will tell you, is demonstrating that, in fact, distributing naloxone, the antidote, does not cause people to use more. Many of the opponents to this antidote say, oh, if you put this antidote into users' hands, they're going to have a safety net, and that's going to cause them to use a great deal more, take more risks. So we're collecting data on that, and I can tell you that what we're actually seeing is a reduction in use, not an increase in use.
You are also a professional documentarian. In 2005, you established your own nonprofit organization. Sawbuck is the title, I believe, of your company.
Yeah.
You produce media explicitly to help addicts. How do you do that?
We produce documentary films, and I'm also a series contributor to Chicago Public Radio's 848 program, WBEZ. And I did a four-part series on a homeless encampment on the west side of Chicago. However, we also do, so we do some like observational documentary film work and some relatively traditional documentary audio work. And our kind of work requires us to move into the scene and live and stay for long periods of time, you know, from 2 weeks to 2 years in a homeless encampment or a shooting gallery or a crack house. However, we also produce training films. We're just about to finish, for instance, a film that trains heroin and opiate users on how to use naloxone, the antidote, to reverse overdose so that they can then teach their peers and so on.
You also do research and work with sex workers. How does this overlap, the drug addiction, with the sex worker scene in Chicago?
Well, the number one mechanism for females who have a drug addiction and are living at or near street level for making money is prostitution. So there is, you know, estimates range from 70 to 90% of all females in the street drug economy are engaging in prostitution on a daily basis in order to generate revenue that will help them to buy the drugs they need to satisfy the addiction.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes, I know, left with you. You have to go, but can you sum these things up? You've been involved in this firsthand, also in academic work. I'd be interested in your observations about how this country has tried to curb drug abuse over the decades, its drug control policy. What have we learned in the preceding decades about what works and what does not?
Well, pretty much everything we've done in law enforcement has not only failed to reduce the problem, to eliminate the problem, but has actually worsened the problem. Our law enforcement policies and practices are based on the principle of destabilization. We work to destabilize drug dealers, to destabilize drug addicts through detection and arrest and sometimes even abuse, physical abuse, and to incarcerate them repeatedly, which is that's one of the highest risk factors for an overdose, by the way, recent incarceration. And what we need to understand is that from a diagnostic perspective, from a clinical perspective, instability is a central diagnostic criterion for the disease of addiction. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't make very much sense then to proceed in continuing to destabilize addicts when instability is at the very core of the disease they have.
In 30 seconds, we have to go. In 30 seconds, tell me what would be the perfect world for you to curb drug abuse.
Okay, well, it would be to pull in the reins on our criminalizing of a disease. We have criminalized addiction. We need to stop doing that. We need to raise the threshold or raise the level of services, low threshold services that we provide as alternatives to drug abuse. We need to increase the availability of methadone and other alternative opioids for therapeutic treatment, and also increase the availability of things like syringe exchange and make naloxone the antidote available to every single household in the country.
Greg Scott, thank you for joining us, Director of Research for the Chicago Recovery Alliance. Good luck and congratulations on this ambitious and very successful work in saving lives in Chicago. Thank you, Greg.
Okay, thank you, Ben. Take care.
Greg, you too. Greg Scott is featured in the new National Geographic Channel miniseries called Drugs, Inc. The series looks at how our society's most abused drugs are being abused and where we stand in reducing the harm they bring to people's lives. The series premieres this Sunday, July 11th at 7 p.m. Central. Let's go out with another clip from Drugs, Inc.
Methamphetamine addiction is a global epidemic. And nowhere more than America, the largest methamphetamine market in the Western Hemisphere. Dealers sell meth on the streets, and a new wave of self-manufacturing means it's even easier to produce at home. In the state of Missouri, an estimated 53,000 people use methamphetamine. Steve Box was an addict for 10 years. He first tried meth at the age of 25 while experimenting with cocaine.
Very first times was when you would be using cocaine and somebody would have some meth and it would look similar to cocaine and you would like snort some and you'd know immediately it wasn't cocaine, that it was crank, because it burns like somebody sticking a hot poker up your nose.
Steve is one of the only 6% of addicts who managed to kick the habit. Now he's dedicated to helping others fight meth addiction. He's written two books about his struggle and runs a Christian campaign called Meth Equals Sorcery.
When I got off meth, I wrote the book Meth Equals Sorcery, and we send the book to prisoners that are locked up in prisons, and we've probably been close to 100,000 books put into the American county jail and prison system.
He receives hundreds of letters from meth addicts seeking his support.
Just a few today, but Texas, and Oklahoma.
Okay, that's another excerpt from Drugs, Inc., premiering this Sunday on the National Geographic Channel. That's The Exchange for today. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer, Catherine Perkins, and Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.